listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Uncertainty, the sermon by the Reverend Rick Skidmore, presented on Sunday, March 15th, 2015.
So the other night at dinner with friends, we were all of us lamenting about how difficult it is to stomach watching the evening news these days. There's just so much uncertainty in the world, politically and economically and environmentally. And I know you could say that it's always been that way. There's always a certain degree of uncertainty about life. I think being a self-aware human being brings with it a certain level of chronic anxiety and uncertainty. And of course, time and place really affect the level of one's uncertainty. For example, living through the Cuban Missile Crisis was uncertain in degree, say, more than living through the uncertainty of finding a new pastor. The uncertainty of living in eastern Iraq or northern Syria or Ferguson, Missouri is really a different level of uncertainty and challenge than, say, living here in Portland. So we live in a world of plurality and diversity and uncertainty, and always late breaking news, where faith is an endless frontier and in some ways an open book. And the only way to stay faithful and relevant to such a world, I think, is for us to acknowledge that there really is more than one path. There really is more than one way to God. More than one franchise for peace or salvation or enlightenment, if you will, which is not the model or the landscape that most religions identify with or embrace. I mean, in the history of religion, we almost never encounter those kind of wide open spaces. To the contrary, most religions have relied on what the historians call religious triumphalism, which is the belief that my faith is the one true faith, that my way is really the only path to salvation, and that in the end, my tribe, my people, will be saved, and yours will have to fend for themselves. On the institutional side, this is really a central article of faith for many faith traditions, for Christianity, for Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, to name a few. Which is to say that in each of these traditions, there have always been those who are absolutely certain, absolutely convinced that their way, and only their way, will finally triumph as the one true religion, the only effective means or path to God. These people live with the blessing of certainty. They know they're saved. They know they're right. And they know that you're wrong. But I think such certainty comes at a very high price. And in order to embrace such a position, you sort of have to move and live in this fortress of isolation, where the only people who are allowed in are those who share your same beliefs, who share the same language, the same customs, the same assumptions, the same certainty, and the same worldview as you. And anyone who is not on your particular triumphant path is then viewed with suspicion and distrust. So if there's only one path to God and truth and I'm on it, then what am I to do with those who claim to be on another equally valid path to God? If I'm certain that I'm right, then must I be equally certain that others are wrong. And religious fundamentalism doesn't really have an exclusive claim on this approach, on this kind of thinking. I mean, there are atheists who are absolutely certain that there is no God, and they dismiss any religious faith as misguided or ignorant. There are governments who are absolutely certain that they are right in their approach to governing, and that their enemies are absolutely wrong. There are political parties and pundits who maintain that only their outlook can bring health and prosperity to the country, and that any other path will bring ruin or disaster. I mean, there are entire news outlets that propagandize for one specific political point of view and shun all others, any variation. And the nice part about living in such a fortress of isolation, where there really is no other legitimate perspective except your own, is that you can feel somewhat secure in that. You can enjoy a group think, a group identity and cohesion that develops easily in this kind of environment of uniformity of thought and practice and ritual. So from the lofty heights of certainty, you can pass judgment on others. You can pass judgment on what is good and what is evil, what is truth, what is heresy. You can proceed with a sense of stability and order, occupying the same unyielding territory and repeating the same ancient formulas that take you down that one path to glory, your path. But again, all of this confidence about the past and the present and the future comes, I think, at a very, very high price. Because in the land of certainty, there can be no room for anybody outside of my group. Because if I ever have to acknowledge their validity, their presence, their dignity in somebody who follows a different path, then I can no longer be certain that my way is really the only way. When you venture into the land of faith rather than certainty, where God is still speaking, then you're acknowledging the possibility that this can be true, but also this can be true, that there's room for more than just my truth. In such a place, a Christian can say, you know, Jesus is for me a way, a truth, and a life. But that doesn't mean that Jesus is the end and the proof and the conclusion. Jesus may be my way, my truth, my life. But you see, such a faith statement really allows for the fact that Jesus is not the way, the truth, the life for the Jewish community or for Buddhists or for Muslims. These are brothers and sisters. They have their own path. They have their own truth. They have their own way. And if you can get to this point, something I think very exciting begins to take place. I mean, once you have broken out of that fortress of isolation and certainty, once your way doesn't have to overpower any other way, once you are secure enough in your own faith, convictions, and experience to allow for the expression and for the possibility of another person's experience, then I think a door opens to new life and to new ground. Something new at that point can enter into your world and can break into your life. The stranger who is no longer a stranger can shed new light and new insight, can teach you about not only their faith, but also can lead you to a deeper understanding of your own faith. Your own convictions, your own experiences, your own hopes and dreams will more than likely remain, but you hold on to them not in the shell of certainty, but rather you see them as gifts, which are part of a living tradition that is always growing and taking new shape, a living faith, a living relationship, which again is always moving and growing and changing, as one would hope any relationship would be. If you can't proceed with certainty, then you're left with a certain amount of uncertainty. And that means, among other things, I think, an open acknowledgement of our humanness, of our human frailties and limitations, our lack of understanding, our ignorance about some things. I looked up uncertainty in the dictionary, and it doesn't really shed much light. Uncertainty, meaning unsafe, unsure, vague, ambiguous, chancy, a gamble, obscure, random, not the sort of qualities that people would want, would go out of their way to try to cultivate. But in the United Church of Christ, we really have this history, this legacy of embracing uncertainty. We claim that there is no certainty in creeds or formulas or church hierarchies or pronouncements. I mean, the signature line in the United Church of Christ and a lot of its recent promotions as a denomination is, anybody know? I'll get you started. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. So the UCC really attempts to offer, to welcome the stranger, to offer respect and encouragement to people regardless of ability, age, race, stature, economic circumstance, sexual orientation, and I would add faith expression. No matter who you are, where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. I find this to be a beautiful vision and a terrible business model. Because everybody knows if you want to build a church, what you got to do is you find a bunch of like-minded people, you set in stone a few sort of unimpeachable values, judgments, and then you grow from there. I don't think the world has or ever will beat a path to the doors of the United Church of Christ. Because the principle of uncertainty and openness and inclusion and diversity in religion never draws the masses. We will always be, I think, but this remnant of faithful seekers. But I still think that we play a crucial role, a critical role in keeping the world alive, alive to hope and to reconciliation and to new possibilities. Every life is full of uncertainty in our daily lives, in the workplace, in our relationships, in our living life and loving one another. But I think nothing in all of human experience more exposes our limitations and our ignorance and our lack of safety and our vulnerability than the fact of death. In the fortress of fundamentalism, death is really dismissed as being not a big deal, unreal, almost trivial. For those who are so certain of salvation, death is really little more than an annoyance. But for those who take up residence in the notion of a free and growing faith, then there's no such subterfuge, no such protection from the full impact of the pain and loss of death. Rather than certain knowledge about death, a free faith walks straight into the valley of the shadow and says that each of us, we have to contend with that reality openly. We have to contend with our own sorrow and our own frailties and our own helplessness and our own limited knowledge of this great mystery. At death, you and I turn not to the certainty of salvation, but to this continual reliance always on the grace of God. And we don't see a funeral service as an occasion to propagandize or to evangelize our particular point of view about heaven. Rather, we try to understand the mystery, the promise, the light that filled one human life, and to celebrate that. We don't presume to understand ultimate judgment and meaning other than to voice our own conviction that if God is the God of love, then all souls will find in the end refuge and peace in the heart of God. All souls will get to where they need to go. But no matter what we say, we disclaim the arrogant pronouncement about who's in and who's out. We acknowledge instead this awesome mystery of life and death and the limitations that we all of us hold in terms of knowledge and in terms of vocabulary and form and ritual. And I'm simply saying that this is really not a very easy place or position. This is not an easy journey we're trying to make here. And it doesn't, never has, never will have much mass appeal. And if the church down the street, you know, wants to offer certainty and protection from the ambiguities of life and the threat of death, then who can blame people from walking right past this place where we offer no such consolation? Sometimes I'm astounded that anybody would bother to show up here at all. Which leads me to think that the reason we attract even a few is that we happen to be doing something right. Not in the sense that everybody else is wrong, but in the sense that the uncertainty that we freely admit to here in our prayers and in our worship, from the pulpit, from the pew, is a basic fact of human life. It's a basic fact of human experience. There are those who are able or willing or maybe unable to ignore the compelling need, you know, to confront life and to live with paradox and ambiguity and finitude in this constantly evolving, mysterious process of life. So here, we will never presume certainty because we have become aware of human limitation and sin. Here, we can't provide a safe and easy formula for living or for dying because we have a conscious understanding of the mystery and the complexity at the very heart of life. Here, we attempt to worship as best we can in spirit and in truth because we have lost our faith in human formulas and outward posturing. And whether we've grown complacent with our certainty or inactive in our spiritual seeking because of our uncertainty, I think it seems that all of us would do well to return for a moment to Jacob's well and to drink deep and to consider again what is being offered to us in this encounter between Jesus and the Samaritan woman. Jesus comes to the well of his spiritual ancestors to drink. And in so doing, he ignores the taboos of his particular tribe, his culture, his time, which forbids him to talk to a woman, let alone a Samaritan. It's really no exaggeration to suggest that Samaritans in Jesus' day were perceived in the same way that Palestinians are seen today. You know, people who share a common spiritual ancestry, but who for generations have been pushed out, kept out, considered outsiders because of land disputes and power plays, and this belief that my tribe, my nation, my view of religion is superior to yours. But Jesus here doesn't recognize the formulas or the limitations and decrees of human law or religion. He sees and he chooses to obey only one law, that we are all of us children of the same Spirit, that we all of us are children of the same God, though we may call this God by different names. And he maintains that no matter what truth or tradition we swear allegiance to, that there is water to be drawn, and that we are all of us asked in our limited capacities and conditions to serve and to care for one another. Jesus maintains that there is a thirst which can only be quenched by living water. That is to say, by a personal relationship with God, an actual communion with holiness. And this is not to be accomplished in Mecca or on Mount Sinai or in the temple in Jerusalem, as stately and as awe-inspiring as these places might be, or as popular and as acceptable as these places of pilgrimage are for thousands. But Jesus is telling us that the hour has come, it's already here, he says, when we're called to worship God in spirit and in truth. Jesus comes to us with this message that there's something new that is breaking into your world in this moment, calling for your attention. And it's not to be found in the dogmas of the church. It's not to be found in end times triumphalism, no matter how secure it may make its followers feel. And neither is it to be found by those who have dismissed or forgotten their thirst and their hunger for something spiritual, something radically unexpected. Something as astounding as a Jewish man recognizing God and a Samaritan woman. Something novel and huge is happening as we sit in the middle of this uncertain world, ever changing. God is calling out to each of us, inviting us to participate in this life of the Spirit, pulling down the barriers, the walls that separate us as neighbors and as nations, discarding all of those easy formulas which assure us of our salvation and yet put us in conflict with every other group on the planet. God invites us to worship at the one synagogue, the one mosque, the one church, the one and only holy place that will outlast all of the structures that we have fabricated over the centuries to try to hem God in and keep others out. We are invited into the temple of the living God, into the human heart and mind and soul, from deep within that hidden spring, life wells up. There is power there to change our lives and to heal us, to breathe new life into us. Amid all of life's hardships and uncertainties and sins and errors, may our thirst be quenched at such a well.